From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief for July 15th. Hi, it's Iris. July 15th, 10 in health. The one that made me reread the abstract is at the top. Let's get into it. First, from New Atlas, gas station heroin sparks emergency drug crackdown in the US. The DEA's request rests on a growing collection of emergency room reports and poison center calls that link a widely sold over-the-counter supplement to opioid-like overdoses. No controlled trial exists. The evidence is observational, compiled from dozens of incidents across multiple states. Regulators argue the product's active ingredient, often a synthetic opioid analog, has a potency comparable to heroin, yet it's sold in gas station aisles without any prescription or warning label. Because it can cause respiratory depression and dependence, they're asking the Attorney General to place it in Schedule Y, the most restrictive category. If the petition succeeds, the supplement would be removed from retail shelves and manufacturers would face criminal penalties for continued distribution. Existing stock would have to be seized or destroyed, and pharmacies could no longer dispense it. The move is a rapid response to a public health signal rather than a long-term policy shift. It underscores how quickly a seemingly benign product can become a crisis when its pharmacology mimics illicit opioids. Next, second from New Atlas. Westphalia's half-pop camper bus absorbs a Class A luxury RV into a van. Westphalia has taken its classic pop-up camper vibe and built it into a standard Fiat Ducato, turning a modest van into a four-sleeper home on wheels. Inside, the layout mirrors what you'd find in a high-end Class A motorhome. Think a full kitchen, a bathroom with a shower, and a separate sleeping area. Yet the price stays far below custom builds. The design focuses on practical luxury, solid cabinetry, insulated walls, and a compact yet functional living space, all fitted without major structural changes to the base van. For anyone who wants the comfort of a big RV, but prefers a smaller, more affordable vehicle, this new Westphalia model offers a solid middle ground. Up next, third, from FizzOrg. Elephants turn footsteps into messages through ground and skull vibrations. So, I was reading about elephants and how they communicate with each other over long distances. They're already pretty good at sending signals through the air, but it turns out they can also use vibrations in the ground to send messages. These vibrations start in their feet, travel up through their legs, and then through the bones in their skull to their inner ear. This way of hearing is called bone conduction hearing, and it lets them pick up signals from as far as 10 kilometers away. And then, fourth, from Mongabay, how a spiritual practice is preserving Benin's mangroves. In the West African nation of Benin, Vodun, an ancient spiritual religion rooted in a deep connection between humans and nature, has become a primary tool for protecting the country's disappearing mangroves. By invoking the authority of the Zangbeto deity, local communities and conservationists create spiritual sanctuaries that forbid the destruction of mangroves under threat of divine punishment, reports Mongabay Africa's Jahaina Lewisin. Mangroves are vital carbon sinks, capable of capturing up to four times as much carbon as terrestrial forests. Benin's mangroves are under extreme pressure from logging, salt production, intensive agriculture, and urbanization. Between 1995 and 2015, mangrove cover in the country decreased by 29%, according to a study published in 2025. To combat this loss, the NGO EcoBenin partners with Vodun dignitaries to designate specific areas as sacred. In the last decade, this collaboration has preserved about 500 hectares, more than 1,235 acres of mangroves. The process involves seeking permission from the spirits through a far priest, a mediator who uses a traditional spiritual language to communicate with the divine. In the video, Isidore Ginu, a 57-year-old advertising director and the son of a fisherman, emphasizes the importance of this spiritual oversight for the Mono River region in the southwestern corner of Benin. This region is home to Bouche du Roi, an estuary and one of the richest mangrove ecosystems on the Beninese coastline. All our resources, all our wealth comes from the water, Jinu, who was initiated into the Vodun religion 14 years ago, tells Mongabai. This article was originally published on Mongabai Next, 5th from Fizz.org, AI Explorer's tool for unraveling radicalization's complex drivers. Micah van den Herk's PhD work, defended cum laude, used machine learning models to map how personal, social, and online factors intertwine in radicalization. She trained the algorithms on large, anonymized data sets of social media activity, survey responses, and demographic records, then let the system highlight which combinations most often preceded extremist shifts. The analysis showed that no single variable drives radicalization. Instead, clusters of modest influences like echo chamber exposure, identity stress, and local grievances combine in different ways for different people. The AI didn't claim a universal cause, just a nuanced map of probable pathways. Because it's a single doctoral study, the findings are exploratory, not definitive. They suggest AI can help untangle complex social phenomena, but broader replication and real-world testing will be needed before policy or intervention decisions rely on them. Up next, 6th, from This Is Precious, The Absurdities of It All. I'm taking a quick breath to pull the thread through what's happening. The writer has hit a wall of exhaustion and is stepping away for a month to let their nervous system reset, pausing subscriptions for a few weeks while they recharge. They're also sharing how they've turned a tiny Notting Hill studio into a makeshift camp, mattress, linen, a frozen vodka bottle for cooling, a colander propping a window, because any artificial noise sends them into fight or flight mode. Even with that setup, they're only getting 3 hours of sleep a night. The piece then drifts into a reflection on absurdity. The author describes a day that spiraled from podcasts and lunch to a frantic bike ride to a House of Lords event, only to find the venue tucked inside a cosmetic store whose fragrance they can't tolerate. The crowd recognized the sensory trigger, and the writer framed the whole episode as a microcosm of larger societal contradictions, the clash between big picture collapse and everyday life. From there, they weave in a few cultural snapshots, a vice president memoir warning of civilizational decline, a right-wing commentator worrying about post-Christian Europe, and tech leaders warning that political unrest, not AI itself, could be the biggest risk. The common thread is the idea that we're all navigating increasing discord and that learning to sit with discomfort is becoming a kind of superpower. Finally, the author nudges listeners toward philosophy as a practical skill for this era, noting that as AI handles routine questions, big picture thinking will be more valuable. They sprinkle in oddball news: someone using OnlyFans to fund a mountain climb, a Buddhist robot monk in South Korea, to underline how the world feels both surreal and urgent. The takeaway is simple. Acknowledge the absurd, lean into the uncomfortable, and keep questioning. And then, 7th, from New Atlas, Ducati presents its first ever racing supermotard in the Desmo 450 SM. Ducati finally added a true racing-focused supermotard to its lineup. The new Desmo 450 SM sits beside the Hypermotard, which has long been the brand's most recognisable bike in the category. But this model is built specifically for competition rather than street-oriented riding. The Desmo 450 SM uses a 450cc liquid-cooled engine tuned for higher revs, a lightweight chassis, and race-grade suspension components. It's marketed as a ready-to-go entry for riders who want a bike that can jump straight onto a track without extensive modifications. In short, Ducati's first dedicated racing supermotard is now available, filling a gap that fans have been waiting for and giving racers a purpose-built option from the factory. Next, 8th from Mongabay. Bill Montevecchi showed what seabirds could tell us about the sea. Bill Montevecchi spent over 5 decades studying seabirds in the North Atlantic, off the coast of Newfoundland. He saw them as more than just inhabitants of the ocean, but as observers that could provide valuable insights into the state of the ecosystem. By tracking their breeding success, feeding trips and absences, Montevecchi gathered evidence about fish stocks, changing currents, pollution, and other environmental changes that were otherwise invisible to humans. His work helped establish seabirds as indicators of environmental change long before it became a widely accepted concept. Montevecchi's research spanned academic journals, government advisory panels, newspaper columns, and radio interviews. He was driven by a desire to understand what the birds were saying and to share that information with others. Born in New York, Montevecchi developed an interest in birds at a young age and trained as an ornithologist before moving to Newfoundland, where he spent most of his career at Memorial University. The province offered Montevecchi a unique opportunity to study seabird colonies, productive seas, and unanswered questions. He was particularly drawn to the area's immense seabird populations, which provided a wealth of data on the health of the ocean ecosystem. Through his work, Montevecchi shed light on the complex relationships between seabirds, fish, and the environment, and inspired a new generation of researchers to follow in his footsteps. Montevecchi's legacy extends beyond his research, as he was also a skilled communicator who could distill complex scientific concepts into accessible language. He was a beloved figure in Canadian marine science, known for his ability to connect with both experts and the general public. His work continues to inspire and inform our understanding of the ocean and its inhabitants. In the end, Montevecchi's approach to science was characterized by a deep respect for the natural world and a commitment to sharing his knowledge with others. His passing leaves a void in the world of marine science, but his contributions will continue to be felt for years to come. Up next, 9th from phys.org. Nitrate in drinking water may be linked to preterm births in New Zealand. So researchers in New Zealand looked at the connection between nitrate levels in drinking water and preterm births. They analysed a huge number of births, over 735,000, that happened between 2008 and 2021. What they found is that even when nitrate levels were pretty low, below what's currently considered safe, there was still a higher risk of preterm birth. This study is based on a large data set, which makes the findings more reliable. The researchers were able to estimate the nitrate levels in the drinking water where each mother lived and then compare that to how long she was pregnant. The results suggest that nitrate in drinking water might be a factor in preterm births, even at levels that are currently considered acceptable. It's worth noting that this is just one study, and more research would be needed to confirm these findings. But the fact that they found a link even at low nitrate levels is something to pay attention to. The current drinking water standard might need to be re-evaluated to make sure it's protective of public health. The study's findings are based on a robust analysis, but it's also important to consider that there could be other factors at play that contributed to the results. More studies would help to clarify the relationship between nitrate in drinking water and preterm births. For now, though, this research suggests that it's an area worth looking into further. And then, 10th, from phys.org. When words signal conflict, measuring exclusionary nationalism in pre-war Japan. So, researchers are looking into how exclusionary nationalism, or the idea that one's own nation is superior, contributes to war. They found that when people hold these attitudes, they tend to prefer words from their own language over foreign ones, and might even reject words from languages they view as enemy languages. This is based on a study that analysed language patterns in pre-war Japan, where exclusionary nationalism was on the rise. The study suggests that language can be a subtle but telling indicator of these attitudes. It's worth noting that this study focused on a specific historical context, but the findings could have implications for understanding how language influences conflict in other situations. That's the read. Small inputs, compounding results. Back tomorrow. Want this every morning? It's free. Set up your own feed at storyflow.com.